take a look at your pet's health. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have with me today Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. We will be talking with her about why pets get more ear infections in the summer. We'll take a look at canine flu, talk about our breed of the month, and of course, we will be answering all of your pet care questions, so I hope you'll join in. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Send us an email to ideas@WPR.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Just search for the Larry Mueller Show. And Sandy, welcome back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
We already have a post on our Facebook page.
Yes, I see there's a dog on a paddleboard. I actually have a friend who has a cat that goes out with them, believe it or not. And but, you know, it's, what's really cool to see is the dog's got a harness on that I believe is a life jacket. So they're doing that summer safety stuff that we always recommend, that you have your dog near water. Make sure that they're protected, because if you're too far from shore, they may get, you know, misdirected and start heading out into deeper water.
You know, if the pets, of course, they're in water more now than they are at any other time. Is this a source of the reason for the increase in ear infections?
You would think that. And swimming definitely can cause dogs to have a lot more moisture in their ears, and it can predispose them to it. But probably the number one thing that we see causing ear infections in the summer is allergies. And all those summer allergies that everybody's sneezing and blowing their nose and so on with stuff that's pollinating and blowing around is also causing our dogs to have skin problems. And the ears and the feet are the big things that we see with allergies. And so don't always blame it on the water, although that can be a cause, you know. But we have to start looking at maybe some type of underlying allergic dermatitis type problem. You know, I think the reason I wanted to bring this up is I've been getting some owners coming in and doing kind of home remedies for cleaning their dog's ears. And a couple of things that I've heard recently, one actually went and bought a human ear cleaner because their dog's ears were stinky. And they thought, well, we can use that. Most human ear cleaners are going to have a peroxide base to them. And because our ear canal goes straight in, we can shake our head and turn our head to the side and flush it out very easily. But dogs, their ear canal is J-shaped or, you know, backwards J, depending on what side of the head you're on.
Yeah.
And that will trap that cleaner down in that base.
Ooh, ouch.
And it burns.
Yeah.
And so it's meant to be flushed out. So don't use human ear cleaners. I've had people using things like vinegar and to acidify the ear. That potentially could, you know, be a problem. Most ear debris is going to be greasy, and imagine putting oil and vinegar together. What happens? Just sits on top. So vinegar, although it may acidify the ear and help decrease yeast growth, is not a good thing to be throwing in the ear without having it in a base with something that's going to help break up the wax as well. And the last thing I've had people be using at home is alcohol. Can you imagine you've got a red, sore, painful ear and you dump rubbing alcohol on top of it? Oh my goodness, that has to burn and sting. And so when your dog has an ear infection, make sure that you see your veterinarian. Not only will they look down in the ear to see if there's something like foreign bodies in there, they'll take swabs to be able to see what organisms are causing the infection, whether it be bacteria or yeast or a combination of the two. Get on the right cleaner, the right treatment protocol. And things are easy now. There's a lot of really good cleaners that are very directed towards what we're treating, whether it's a yeast or bacterial infection. And some of the newer treatments out now are actually medications that you put in the ear and you don't have to touch the ear for an entire month. It doesn't work for everything, but there are things out there to kind of make it a little bit easier for owners. So don't let your dog suffer with an ear infection this summer.
You know, I think it was probably 2 years ago that you talked about the canine flu that was reported in Chicago. Are there updates on that?
There is. And this is something, it's never gone away. It's just been kind of very low levels here and there. But just recently, there was a major outbreak down south. It started, they believe, this was in May, at a dog show down in Florida, and is now spread up, as like the last report was up in Tennessee. And they're pretty much almost every state in the nation has had episodes of dogs coming down with this canine influenza. One of the reasons why I wanted to bring this up is that I've had owners look at their vaccination records and think that their dog has been vaccinated for influenza, when really they've been vaccinated for another viral infection called parainfluenza. The two are totally different. And the difference between them, the influenza vaccine is a totally separate vaccine. It's not combined with the distemper and parvo. And it does require that dogs receive two doses of the influenza vaccine separated by 2 to 4 weeks. And we have several boarding facilities in the Madison area that are now requesting that dogs be vaccinated, not requiring it, but requesting it. And so you need to make sure that if you need to plan ahead, get your dog immunized. And you don't even have to have contact with other dogs to be able to get this disease. It can be spread through the environment.
Oh,
it can
boy.
Survive in the environment for like 48 hours. So if a dog had been someplace, your dog may be, able to be picking it up and survive on clothing and your skin and so on. Your skin, not so long, about 12 hours. So handling another dog and then coming home to your dog could be a way of transmitting it. And we know that dogs, about 20% of dogs never show symptoms that get exposed to the canine influenza bug. About 80% of them will become symptomatic. We see about a 10% mortality rate. So it can be, that's pretty high,
yeah.
Especially for those older dogs that may have other respiratory problems or heart disease and things that could be complicating them dealing with this disease. Once your dog even recovers from it, they can shed it for up to 3 weeks. So those normal dogs that look healthy at the dog park may actually be carrying this bug. So this would be something I'd recommend that everyone that has dogs that are social, that are out with other dogs, frequent dog areas, talk to your veterinarian about getting your dog vaccinated, especially if you're traveling this summer to other states, because we do know that it just randomly shows up.
Oh. Something else to worry about.
Yes.
But you can avoid the worry by getting the shot.
Getting the vaccines done, yes.
Twice,
right.
Well, let's go to Diane in Cornell, who has a question for you, Sandy. Let's go there. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
What's Hello. On your mind?
Well, I adopted a King Charles Spaniel. She's about 5 years old, and she was a breeder dog at a facility, I'm assuming was a puppy mill. And shortly after I received her, I noticed she does a lot of itching on one side towards her ear. And I looked it up and I thought, well, maybe it's this neurological issue they have, but it wasn't bad. But now it's progressed into tail chasing. And sometimes, well, just once last week, all of a sudden she yelped out in pain, and I thought, something had happened, but I couldn't find anything.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it sounds like she does have, I can't pronounce it, but what is my next step?
Okay.
Yeah,
unfortunately, King Charles Cavalier Spaniels are prone to having this disease that is called syringomyelia, and it affects about 95% of them. So it's like really rampant in the breed, and it can what it basically is that their brain is too big for the size of their skull. They have been selected to have a smaller skull, and so part of the brain called the cerebellum and the brainstem gets squashed. We're at the back end of the skull, and you start getting spinal fluid kind of building up in that area. It can be very painful for these dogs, and they often present just as your dog did, with scratching the neck. They may have other neurologic signs as well. It can be, like I said, very painful for them to deal with, and unfortunately not easy to treat. Usually what we're looking at for treatment is having them on pain medications. The medications that we use typically will jump to using one called gabapentin. It's a human medication that's very safe to use in dogs, and it's helpful for neuropathic pain or nerve pain. So that would be something to be talking to your veterinarian about. The next step, if pain medication isn't working, would be to do some further workup to see how bad things are. And that would mean coming in and visiting with a veterinary neurologist and having an MRI done of your dog's skull and head and upper neck area to evaluate what's going on there to see if there is something that they could potentially do surgically to be able to help your dog. Obviously, we're talking about, you know, very complicated surgery. It's not something that you want to go into lightly. That's why we try to manage these cases medically. And it's unfortunate that she has this, because that's what we're trying to do, is get breeders to maybe start selecting for dogs that have a bigger skull. And if she was used for a breeder, this your little dog is just added to the problem that we see with this cute little dog breed. So I'm so sorry. I wonder if the tail chasing could be something else, though.
Yeah.
Because we don't typically see kind of compulsive disorders like that with tail chasing as a symptom of syringomyelia in these dogs. Sometimes when we've had dogs that have been raised in a kennel situation, very stressful, maybe not a lot of environmental enrichment, they can develop abnormal behaviors to pass the time. And one of them that we'll see sometimes is tail chasing, where they just start spinning in their cage. And that may be something that she's doing at your house, just like when she's anxious or something like that. Like maybe you're leaving and she starts to get distressed, she may start spinning. So watch when she starts doing this, because that would be something that would be treated very differently, usually with psychoactive drugs like fluoxetine, things like that, that may help decrease some of these repetitive disorder or repetitive behaviors that dogs may develop.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Let's go to Stacy in Oconomowoc next. Hi, Stacy.
Hi. Okay, so I have a French bulldog, and she's 1 year old now, and she's allergic to storage mites. And so I understand there are storage mites in almost every dried food.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't feed her canned food because it doesn't agree with her system. She was getting diarrhea and having some blood in her intestines.
Uh-huh.
So I've been cooking for her, and I came up with about 4 good recipes that I think I have covered almost every things she needs, vegetable
okay.
and meat and stuff like that. Anyway, my question is, should I be giving her a multivitamin? What are the chances that she's getting enough nutrition from what I'm cooking for her?
So one thing that I didn't hear is there a mineral source in her food? What are you using for calcium and phosphorus?
Cottage cheese is one of the things.
Yeah. No, I think I'm all for you making a homemade diet, but it needs to be a balanced diet. And many of the recipes that you're just going to be finding online are not made by veterinary nutritionists. They're just somebody has come up with them. So I'd really want to look at the credentials of the person that's come up with the recipe that you're using. If there's a popular cooking show host that has a magazine out, and she puts in dog food recipes in her magazine. And I'm like, where did you get your nutrition degree? And none of these are balanced diets at all. And people get fooled into thinking, well, because it's published, I can go ahead and use this. So a couple of things that I would be recommending. One is talk to your veterinarian. They may be able to help you out by getting you in touch with a veterinary nutritionist. You can even do it on your own. If you go to the American College of Veterinary Nutritionists, there is links there for veterinarians that do either online telephone consultations or you can travel to them. And there are groups also that do recipes for you, where you would have to obviously get their supplements and things. One that I particularly like to use is called Balance It. They're out of California. And they sell a supplement that you mix in with the food that you're using. It is a cooked diet. So you can put in the search, like what vegetables you want to use, what protein source you want to use, and make sure you have a kitchen scale, so because everything has to be meticulously weighed out so that everything is in the right amounts. What I will tend to see is people will start with using something like this, And then they start getting into what I call recipe drift. Instead of buying like pork loin to make their pet food, they may say, oh, pork chops are on sale. I'm going to use those instead. And obviously that's going to have a different fat ratio, different protein level and so on. So you really have to be careful that you follow recipes directly. So I hope that you can work with your veterinarian and be able to get your dog on a healthier diet, because as a one-year-old dog, you've got a long life ahead to be able to keep your dog's nutritional system up to snuff. And I don't want to see her suffer from any imbalances.
Stacy, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our on-air producer, here on the Ideas Network. To Adrian in Duluth. Adrian, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
I don't know if you'll be able to answer this question, but I have a Papillon. I think he's like 1 year old, and I was wondering, are Papillons better to train individually or in a group?
I'm not sure why you're asking that question. Sometimes if we have dogs that have not been socialized well with other dogs and, you know, taking them to a group class could be very overwhelming for them. So if you're having issues with your dog, especially in the presence of other dogs, what I would be recommending is having an applied animal behaviorist do a consultation to see, you know, is your dog fearful? What's going on? And is there a way that they can maybe introduce your dog into a smaller group or maybe be in a kind of a different area where they can be observing other dogs being trained, but be off at a distance. There's nothing unique about the Papillon as being a dog that needs to be trained by itself. So I think that it all really depends on kind of the issues that you're having with your dog and whether it would be helpful to, you know, start by itself and then, you know, move into group sessions. But if your dog is social and well-adjusted, I'd say a group session is a great place to start.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. And let's go to Chris in Watertown. Hi, Chris. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I wish you had this doctor on every week.
Thank you.
There are so many needy animals, and I love listening to her talk about all of them. I have two absolutely wonderful cats. And one cat has inflammation of the lining of her stomach and her intestines. And it's a serious condition, and I'd like the doctor's opinion on the treatment. She's getting treatment now, but I'd like her opinion. And then the other is somewhere along the line, both kitties got the herpes virus.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I had a wonderful vet who just suggested when there was a flare-up just to use lysine powder.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the third question is, you mentioned applied animal behaviorist, and I've been wanting to find out how to study to be one of those, and where does a person do that? So I'll shut up now.
All right. Okay. All right. Well, first of all, your cat with inflammatory bowel disease, I'm not sure how that was diagnosed. I would think that if you've got that as a diagnosis, your veterinarian probably did some biopsies to be able to get some answers. I would hope that they've also feline leukemia and FIV tested your cat to make sure that there's no underlying infectious disease that could be causing a problem like this too, because sometimes we will see a problem called gastrointestinal lymphoma look very similar to IBD, and they react, they look almost identical, but obviously different prognosis if you've got an infectious disease causing this because there's no treatment for it. But most cats with IBD, the way we deal with them is often getting them on a hypoallergenic diet. And that doesn't mean just going over to the grocery store and picking a different brand of food. It means usually being on a diet that you get from your veterinarian, and the cat gets that and only that diet. It's a hydrolyzed protein diet. that is not going to be allergenic to the gut. And so there's several brands on the market. Some are better than others, but they are considered to be prescription diets, so you will have to get them through your veterinarian. The reason why I would say don't go to get one over the counter at the grocery store is that many of those foods are made in plants where they're also handling other protein sources. So maybe the diet says that it's, you know, green pea and venison, but it's made in a plant that also handles chicken and beef and so on, kind of like us with peanut allergies. If, you know, where we have a serious allergy to peanuts, if the, you know, the product that you're making may not have peanuts in it, but if it's handled in a plant where peanuts are have been handled, it can trigger an allergic reaction. So tiny, minute amounts of the offending ingredient can trigger this. So that's typically how we handle it. Sometimes kitties need to be on immunosuppressive drugs to be able to keep that inflammation down to a dull roar. But that most cats can be handled just with diet. Your question regarding herpes virus, most cats pick up herpes from their mom. Moms are stressed and they got it from their mom. And it's the disease, it's called rhinotracheitis that we vaccinate for. And the vaccine will help prevent some of the serious complications that we see with the disease, but it does not prevent a cat from being able to pick it up. So even a cat that's vaccinated can still get the disease, but it may not be as serious as we would see in a cat that's not vaccinated. But back, most cats get it from their mom through contact with their infected saliva, their tears, nasal secretions. And like you said, every once in a while you'll get a flare-up. It's the equivalent of us getting cold sores. You know, once you've had a cold sore, you're probably going to get them throughout your life. Whenever you're stressed and have some issues, you may have another one flare up. It's the same class of virus. And your last question, how do you become an animal behaviorist?
Most, an applied animal.
And an applied animal behaviorist. Most of them are, you're looking at probably a college degree with, again, I am not an applied animal behaviorist, but the ones that I do know, many of them have PhDs in animal behavior. They are, you know, have done extensive studying and research. But there are ways of becoming, you know, a good animal trainer through various, you know, like first of all would be to start by just seeing if it's something you really want to do, volunteering at a kennel club or through a group that does teach classes and start, you know, looking into doing some volunteer work. There's different coursework things that you can do that are different programs through like online programs. There's some groups that you can buy almost like a franchise to become an animal behaviorist, but it does take a lot of work and usually university training and you know getting a degree. So
one thing,
one
thing she might do is if there's an applied animal behaviorist in her area, she might just see if she couldn't shadow that person.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of animal behaviorists tell me that about 90% of their work involves working with dogs that bite.
Yes, yes.
And so there, it can be a tough situation.
It can be. And it's a field that I think, you know, we think, oh, wouldn't this be fun to be able to help dogs with, you know, but sometimes it's very sad. And like you said, the aggression cases where, you know, we've got safety at risk and we're looking at euthanasias and things like that. Obviously, animal behaviorists are not going to be going down that path. They would be referring to a veterinarian, but it is an emotional roller coaster when you're working in that field.
Yeah, you might just try and find one and see if you just couldn't spend a day with that person or two. It would be probably an eye-opening experience. Be certainly well worth it to know whether or not you want to go further with it all. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Sandy in Big Bend, it is your turn. Hi, Sandy.
Good to talk to you. I haven't talked to you for a long time. I used to call all the time. I had horses, dogs, cats, guinea pigs, birds. Now I have a Shih Tzu. She's 12 and a half, and it weighs 10 pounds. And she has an absolute terrible, terrible time with storms. She shakes and she pants, and she's just horrible, and you can't stop her. So I tried the collars. I tried coats, whatever. Nothing works. So I got Celio. you know about stelium.
Yes, it's an oral transmucosal dexmedetomidine. Yeah.
Yep, and I'm afraid to use it. She's had trouble before with a medication. This was for fleas and ticks by mouth, and she almost died from that. So I'm really afraid to give this to her, but she really needs something. You can't do anything with her.
Yeah,
older or whatever. She's just terrible.
And there's been no shortage of storms.
That's correct. And I use it in my own dog, and I've been very happy with it. I think the one thing that I, as a veterinarian, I even made the mistake myself, is it comes in a syringe with multiple doses in the syringe, and there's a wheel on it that you have to turn to the correct number of dots of material that you're going to be squirting into the dog's cheek pouch. And, of course, the storm came up in the middle of the night. I got up to treat Bruce and thought I had locked the thing, and instead he got a double dose. And he was a little tired for the next couple of hours, but even with getting like an extra amount in, it is still a very, very safe medication to use. We use it at much higher levels by injection, and it is something that has a reversal agent that can be used. So if you are using it and your dog is having an adverse reaction, there is a reversal agent that we use when we're using the injectable form so that we can wake the dog up, because we're using it at much higher levels where the dog is very, very sedated. And so we want to be able to send them home walking, and it's amazing how fast it turns them around. So I would not be afraid to try it, knowing that that is available and that the safety margin is huge. It's gone through all the FDA testing and regulations to be able to get on the market. And so there's been, not only laboratory testing, but it's also there's been field trial testing, and now it's been out on the market now for approximately a year. And the only fault that we've seen is the fact that that locking device can sometimes be a little tricky to use. So that if you can get your mind around that, I think your dog will do much better during some of these storms.
Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. I want to go back to ear infections a little bit. We may not have covered this, but Kenneth wonders how to tell if your dog has an ear infection.
Well, that is a really good question. Sometimes I can walk into an exam room and I can tell the dog has an ear infection because I can smell it, okay? Because yeast and bacteria will have very distinct odors, and the ear should not smell anything any different than any other part of the dog's body. Lifting up the ear flap and just seeing if it's red. Typically dogs that get ear infections, they'll often have one normal ear and one that's got an infection. So you always got a normal ear that you can look at too. We also want to see if there's any discharge or debris there. Obviously, I don't want you putting a Q-tip down into your dog's ear, but if there's something visible and the ear is red and there's an odor there, then that would be something that should be brought to your veterinarian's attention. Cleaning the ear before you go in for an appointment for an ear infection isn't helpful. It can interfere with us getting a culture result done. It can interfere with us getting cytology done to be able to get your dog on the right medication. So don't think about cleaning that ear, even if you're seeing some debris there. And then also, when things get really bad, now you've got a middle ear infection, the balance may be affected, and the dog may have a head tilt and be walking very ataxic and wobbly. Obviously, there's other causes for vestibular disease in dogs, but if that's accompanying an ear infection, then that means we probably have something pretty serious going on. So those would be the big things to be watching for.
Let's go to Connie in Portage next. Connie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry, and hi, Sandy. I have called before about this. My little corgi has just diagnosed diabetic, and his doctor is one of Sandy's students, and so far he's done the curve and everything, but now they want to do another one. How often do they do the curve?
It really depends on
what is the curve, by the way.
The curve, okay. That's a good, I should answer that first, shouldn't I? it's a kind of a long drawn out program where for an entire day we get the patient, and sometimes owners that are close by will take the dog home and just come back in again, or the cat. And we teach owners how to do this at home as well. It's where we draw blood sugar level, then we feed the dog and give them their insulin. And then every 2 hours, we draw a blood sample and check that blood sugar level and mark it out on a graph so that we can see where it's high, when it drops down low, when it starts going back up again. Because every dog handles insulin differently, and the dosage is, although we start at kind of a recommended dose, it can be all over the place, and sometimes it's the brand of the insulin that we're using, sometimes it is the dose that we're using that we have to make some adjustments. So I think if your veterinarian's wanting to do one, if your dog isn't well regulated at this point, then by all means consider getting this done. But it can be something that you can do at home, and I'd be talking to your veterinarian about home glucose monitoring. There's lots of videos on YouTube showing owners how to do this. I like to do it at home if possible, just because coming into the clinic, they get stressed and that can release cortisone, which can raise the glucose level. And so we can sometimes get some skewed results. So talk to your veterinarian about learning how to do this at home.
I'm going to. I've got the glucometer.
Good.
And yeah. But he's wanting to So I'm going to, what I did before was I took him in every 2 hours so he wouldn't be as stressed.
Right.
But now they said the A1C, his blood sugar level wasn't too bad, but the A1C was like 450 or something. And so what does that mean then?
That sometimes when we're looking at these tests that there's one that we use called fructosamine very frequently in dogs, they look at kind of long-term glucose control. And so when we start seeing these values going up, that tells us that the dog isn't well regulated. So if they did that, found out that, hey, you're not as well regulated as we thought, it may be that we've got some really wide swings in the blood sugar throughout the day where it drops really low and then goes really high. And that's the kind of thing that can be adjusted by working on changing insulin doses, which surprisingly often means sometimes giving less insulin when we've got those wide swings like that in dogs.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Michelle in Marquette, it's your turn now. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a 7-month-old Norwegian Elkhound puppy that we had downstate, and he and his parents and sister all came down with fleas, and then he has been scratching and has a hot spot on his left flank or left thigh.
Mm-hmm.
And then other areas that are kind of crusty around it. I took him to the vet, and she put him on prednisone and Keflex and told me it might be an allergy, may not be related to the fleas, but none of our other dogs have ever had this before.
Yeah.
How do you deal with these things, or where do they...
Well, with the fact that your dog had fleas, we do see dogs developing what's called flea allergy dermatitis, where they become allergic to the saliva that the flea is depositing when they're biting. We just don't see, allergies in dogs under a year of age that often. I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but it's just uncommon. They're usually starting to see signs in their second year of life. We can start seeing allergies usually starting at that point. But I think that the best way of dealing with hot spots, number one, is clipping all the hair away back to normal skin. And with the breed that you've got, that dense hair coat, it's really important to just keep, trim right down with surgical blades so that there's no hair in contact with the oozy sore that's on your dog's leg. That way it can heal up faster, it's going to dry up faster, and it's not going to spread. And people are always surprised because what we see looks like it's just the tip of the iceberg, and you start shaving and you want to get back to normal skin and at least have about an inch barrier of normal skin around it. So some of my patients go home pretty bald when we treat these. And your veterinarian is right. We, treating these with an antibiotic, whether it be something like a topical solution. If it's like a deeper pyoderma, then we end up going with an oral antibiotic. But because of the issues that we see with bacterial resistance being a huge problem in our dog population with skin infections, I'm usually really careful about, maybe getting a culture, making sure I'm using the right antibiotic, especially if we treated a hot spot once and now it's come back again. We want to make sure that we are using the correct antibiotic to get the infection under control.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Thank you very much for calling. Let's go to a Facebook question. Paula asks how feline intestinal lymphoma is diagnosed And do the drugs help to extend the life in a good way?
Yeah, well, GI or gastrointestinal lymphoma can be diagnosed a couple of ways. One is ultrasound kind of makes us suspicious of it because you can see different areas of thickness in the gut when they're looking with the ultrasound. That doesn't give us a definitive diagnosis, but it makes us very suspicious that we've got something going on there. And then we're looking at getting biopsies done. The preferred form of biopsy would be a full thickness, open the belly up and get multiple biopsies and have them looked at. Alternatively, going in, depending on where the area is affected, in the gut is affected, sometimes we can use a scope, but obviously you can't get full thickness biopsies. And so depending on where the disease is occurring via ultrasound, that kind of determines what's going to be the best way to be able to get a definitive answer. And yes, many of these animals do well on medications that are anti-inflammatory drugs, immunosuppressive drugs, and can go on to lead a very normal life, but obviously managed with special diets and medication and, you know, periodic veterinary checks to make sure that they're handling the medication fine.
On to Eric in Baraboo. Hi, Eric. Thank you for calling.
Hey there. Hey, quick question. I have a little Australian cattle dog, and she gets sick every year when I start putting the Vectra on her for the ticks.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of ticks where I live. So is there something else I could try that works?
Yeah, there's a lot of other products on the market, and I'm really fond right now of all the oral flea and tick products that are out there. There's three on the market. Bravecto lasts for 3 months. NexGard and Simparica, which both last for a month. And so that would be something to talk to your veterinarian about. It is a prescription. All of them are prescription products. You can't buy them over the counter. But it's given orally. And I've seen very few side effects in dogs taking this medication. I use it in my own dogs. The interesting thing about Vectra is that the ingredient that is active against ticks in there is permethrin. The other ingredients that are in there are for fleas. And so if you're looking at avoiding what the active ingredient is to get ticks, then I would be avoiding any product that has permethrin in it. And so that would include things like Advantix, which you can get over the counter, and perhaps using a different, if you want to stay with a spot-on treatment, going to a different type of chemical like Frontline. It would be one that you might want to consider that's available over the counter, and there's a number of generic knockoffs now that use the same kind of chemical makeup, but avoiding the permethrin if that's what your dog's reacting to.
All right.
Okay, so another question. Okay, two more questions. You said Revecto, NexGard, and what was the third option?
Simparica. Yeah.
And then my other question is, so I was thinking about spraying my yard with Permethrin. Would that be a bad idea for my dog?
Well, it's not selective for ticks, and so that would be probably environmentally not the best thing to do. And then if your dog is out there, could potentially run into contact with it and have some toxicity issues. They do, I mean, the big thing I think with ticks is, you know, getting rid of brush and things like that. I'm not sure how your backyard is configured, but, you know, keeping grass trim short, keeping your dogs out of areas where there's like low brush and things, because that's where the ticks are going to be hanging out.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Talking your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today. If you have a great photo of your pet, I hope you'll place it up on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Karen sent us a really cute one of Molly and Petey.
Yeah, she's got a Petey too, just like me. And it looks like she's got a wire-haired dachshund and a smooth-haired dachshund. And we were going to be talking about dachshunds later today, but aren't they just snuggled up together in the sunshine?
Carolyn in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi there. I have a 13-year-old Labradoodle that has had a chronic urinary tract infection since last September, and it comes and goes. We managed to get it cleaned up for maybe 6 weeks, and then it's back. And I just was wondering, and it's a bacterial E. coli
An E. coli infection?
Yeah.
And so I assume it's been cultured and they've done sensitivities and are choosing the right antibiotic?
I hope so. We've done cephalexin and we've done amoxicillin and I think there was a third one.
Yeah, and this is all based on culture results? Or
yes.
Okay, so they did do culture results.
And I wouldn't say they do it every time I bring in a sample, but they certainly have done it.
In the past,
yeah.
And that's really important when we've got chronic problems because we do start seeing resistant bugs and we have to pick and choose our antibiotics appropriately. When we have a recurrent urinary tract infection like this, the things that we have to try to determine are, is there something going on with the bladder that is causing your dog to just not be able to clear this? Like, so do they have a bladder wall tumor? Do they have stones in the bladder? And so often doing some imaging, taking x-rays, doing an abdominal ultrasound may be necessary to be able to rule some of those things out. Obviously, I mentioned culturing the urine, and then we will often, when we've got a problem like this, try to figure out, is this dog actually getting rid of the infection while they're on antibiotics and having it come back again later? And so often we will culture while they're on antibiotics to see, are we still having a persistent problem that way? And then culture when they're off of antibiotics to make sure that it truly is gone if it's come back. You know, whether it's a recurrent infection or a persistent infection, meaning that it's just never gone away. So it does take multiple trips going back and forth. And obviously older dogs tend to be more predisposed to things because they've had more time to develop things like bladder stones. I have to assume your dog is symptomatic for these bladder infections. She's having accidents and you're seeing blood in the urine.
I'm not seeing blood in the urine, and she is not having accidents. But what she does is she licks all the time.
Okay. And so we do sometimes, we see a population in especially in female dogs, older female dogs, that can have bacteria in their urine but no sign of a bladder infection. And often we just watch those dogs. It's just they're living with kind of low levels of bacteria, and treating doesn't make any difference. The licking, I worry about, does she have something like vaginitis or, you know, some problem like that? Does she have some urinary incontinence which is causing her to lick? So I'd be focused more on that if your dog isn't showing signs of urgency, urinary accidents in the house, blood in the urine, straining to urinate, all the typical signs that we would see with a urinary tract infection. I'd be focusing more on what's going on the outside of her urinary system and in that vulva area, and see if, you know, if we've got something there that really needs to be treated.
Do you have any suggestions of, you know, after all these pills she's been getting over this last year, she's getting a little pill leery.
Yeah, and that
can really tough to get her to take her.
Yeah, and there are some medications that are now being made beef flavored, like the Keflex or Cephalexin is now in a beef flavored type thing, so you can get a dog specific one that doesn't taste as bad as the human one. I'm a big fan of pill pockets, the things that you can buy over the counter. The Greenies company makes them; they're little squishy treats that you can hide the pill in. And there's a couple of other companies that have come out with them as well. Braunschweiger almost always works, liver sausage.
I've tried that. She does do that.
Okay.
For a while, and then she kind of satiates.
Yeah, and all it takes is that pill slipping out of whatever you're giving it in and them getting it in contact with their mouth, and they become wise to it. So, but I'm really questioning, you know, what's going on with your dog. And if your veterinarian's at a point where they are, like, throwing up their hands and saying, I don't know what's going on, it may be time to be looking at having an internist have a look at her.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And Chris in Darlington. Your turn. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I've got a question that's, it's not exactly a lunch-friendly question, and
okay.
It's about puncture wounds on cats.
Okay.
So my cat had this puncture wound yesterday, and it was already, you know, exploded, and it was like an inch deep. It was really disgusting. And anyway, and a big loose skin flap, and then the skin flap fell off, and now it's about the size of a quarter. It's on the side of his face.
Mm-hmm.
Should I wash it gently with some mild detergent, or
or put antibiotic cream or just leave it alone?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like your cat got into a cat fight. And remember, those cat teeth are like needles and inject bacteria under the skin. And the wound probably happened several days ago, and it just reached ahead, ruptured, the purulent material drained out. Keeping that area clean, you have to be careful with what you use. If it's on the face around the eye, you can use things like betadine, but you'd want to be very careful with using things like chlorhexidine, because that can be a problem for eye contact. Often these cats need to be on antibiotics, and there is an antibiotic that we will use for cat bite abscesses that's an injectable form that is goes by the name of Convenia, because it's very convenient, and you use it once and it lasts for 2 weeks, and it's very helpful for that. Most of the strains of bacteria that we're going to see prevalent in cat bite wounds. So that might be something to talk to your veterinarian about. But yeah, keeping the area clean, but I'd be very careful with what you're using, because getting soaps and things around the eye could potentially be a problem. And any of like the antibacterial ointments may delay healing. So be careful with what you're putting on topically.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, great. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Let's turn to Carol in Oak Creek next. Hi, Carol.
Hi, thank you. I have a couple of unusual questions. I have an elderly corgi. He developed a nose infection, some nodules in his nostrils when it were very smelly, and also he developed hair in his mouth. So he just finished a round of 20 days on amoxicillin, and he is better. His nodules are shrunk, but his nose on the sides are still red. And the vet said put Vaseline on his nose because he's been, you know, licking at his nose because it's been irritating mm-hmm. him. But all he does is he licks off the Vaseline, or he rubs in the carpet to get the Vaseline off.
Yeah, so these nodules were actually inside the dog's nasal cavity?
Yes.
Okay, so your veterinarian scoped the dog to be able to see them? How did they get diagnosed?
I don't know what he did, because he took them in the back.
Okay. I always tell students, you never want to say, let's take the animal to the back, because it sounds like, ooh, you know, the back room. You know, that the treatment area is what I prefer to call it. But that would be something to check with your veterinarian to find out, because being an older dog, I worry about things like nasal tumors causing.
Is that still
there? And the antibiotics just treated maybe a secondary infection that was there, but the underlying problem is still present, and it's just going to get infected again. Sometimes we will see fungal infections in the nose, and they may be smelly as well. So yeah, and so I think that going back to your veterinarian and saying, why were you treating with this particular antibiotic? What did you see up my dog's nose? And maybe be looking at, should we be doing rhinoscopy and potentially biopsying, getting cultures, cytology done, to be able to get some answers so that we can treat your dog appropriately. Again, anything we put on topically in that region, the dog's going to lick off. And so why is the nose irritated to begin with? And if it was treated successfully, that irritation should have gone away.
He also had hair on his teeth.
Yeah, and that's when we see that. That tells me that the dog has been chewing on themselves, and we get hair kind of impacted up under the gum line sometimes.
Oh.
And that's an indication that they've been nibbling on themselves and getting that hair in their mouth. It's not that the hair is growing there. It's just being transferred from the body. And so when I see that, that tells me I better look at the dog's body to see what have you been licking on. And, you know, if your dog has had, you know,
his feet,
so which is usually allergies. And so that, you know, I know it sounds funny. You look in the dog's mouth and then you go, whoa, I got to look at the feet or look around, but they're usually linked that way. So treating whatever's causing your dog to be licking the feet for bacterial yeast infections, allergies would be the next thing to be able to keep your dog comfortable.
There we go. Thank you so much. Brent in Wausau, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I've got a Great Dane who's 5 years old, and he had ACL surgery 2 years ago. He currently has some arthritis in his hip, and he's been kind of dragging his hind legs when walking, has some instability. So we've put him on a couple of supplements, but have had a couple of people recommend to us a raw meat diet that could potentially help his joints? Is that something that...
No, absolutely not. No link at all with helping with the joints. But what I'm really worried about is, does your dog have some type of neurologic problem? We can see giant breed dogs having issues with their neck, disc disease, degenerative spinal cord problems, because I wouldn't expect a dog with just hip dysplasia or knee problems to be dragging their feet. It sounds more neurologic. And so I'd be thinking that would be the next step, would be to get a good neurologic exam done, try to localize what's causing the problem, and maybe that would be something that can be fixed for your dog so that they're not going to have a progressive problem with their back legs. But raw meat, no, too many health risks and not balanced.
There we go. All right. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we had... Nancy on Facebook has an Aussie that hates to be combed and cleaned. Any suggestions on how to do this?
Oh, my goodness. We sometimes have to look at sedating them, whether it be an oral sedative that you can give prior to grooming. Sometimes we have to work with groomers that work with veterinarians so they can be sedated to be able to have the grooming done.
All right. There we go. Thank you so much for that question. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. Join in at 1-800-642-1234. We will take a quick look at the news and weather, and then we'll be back with Dr. Sandy. Stay with us. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have you with us today. Questions, you can join in. Go to our Facebook page. There's some wonderful photos up there, and you can post one of your own pet if you'd like. We'd love to see those photos, and we've got some dandies up here. As a matter of fact, Mick sent us a cool photo of his piebald Dachshund.
And dachshunds happen to be the breed of the month. And I think they're just, as a small breed dog, they have a big dog attitude. You know, they were bred to be hunting dogs, but they come in miniature and standard. We don't tend to see as many standards anymore. The standards can be up to about 30 pounds, but the minis seem to be the most popular that people have. And they come in different colors, combinations, like, you know, the little piebald one that's here. And then we can see them with smooth coats, long haired, wire haired. So there's a number of ways of different configurations. But putting my veterinarian hat on, the big things that I always counsel people about with this is probably the number one health problem that we see in dachshunds is a problem with their back, where they have disc problems. And it all comes down to the fact that they have a cartilage abnormality. They're called chondrodystrophic. They're kind of dwarfed dogs. And that can affect how fast the discs in their back age. And so when dog dachshunds get to be about 2 years of age, they have the discs of a dog that is much older, if they had looked at other breeds of dogs. So they are prone to having intervertebral disc disease, back pain, and neurologic problems. How do we prevent that? Number one is I practice four on the floor. These guys are not allowed to jump up and down off the furniture. You train them to use ramps if they're going to do it, because we don't want that the force of, okay, I can't think of the word, okay. We don't want them damaging their back by jumping. Also keep them skinny. These guys have a nose on them like no other dog, and they love to eat, and they can get overweight very, very easily. And so making sure that you're always keeping them slender so that it takes some of that extra pressure off of their back with that really long back that they have. They're also a dog that as a breed, I tend to see them being overrepresented for having issues with their anal glands. And boy, oh boy, and I think it's just like between Basset Hounds and Dachshunds, they really keep me busy in my clinic. And so, how do we prevent that from being an issue? You can't. You either have to learn how to express them yourself or become very good friends with your veterinarian or vet technician so they can be expressed appropriately by doing a rectal exam. They also get seizures. I have a few that have epilepsy and are well managed with seizure medication, but it's just things that you need to be aware of before you adopt one of these little dogs. But I think they're a wonderful dog. If you like those little tiny dogs and are able to keep them in that good, healthy body condition.
Let's go to Jim in Ashland next. Hi, Jim. Thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a 5-year-old male Newfoundland dog. In late February, he started doing a lot of scratching, and he developed sores on his belly, a little on his back, and in his armpits. So I went to a vet, and they took some blood tests and found out that he's allergic to just about everything outside. So my question is, I got really two questions. How, after 5 years of not having an allergy, does he all of a sudden develop an allergy to the outside? And here it's winter, you know, it's February. And then what can I put on his sores to help kind of heal him up a little bit? The vet did give him some shots, and I have him on some allergy medicine that I put underneath his tongue twice a day.
Okay, so you're using the sublingual drops, and that can take a good year plus to be able to have any benefit. So you haven't been on it long enough to be able to see if it's going to make your dog feel better or not. I think the big thing with treating dogs that have allergies is getting rid of the secondary infections that are there. All of the allergy medications that are out there, like Apoquil that helps stop the itch, and the new Cytopoint, which is an injectable medication that helps, again, it's very directed at the nervous system that triggers the itch response. They work very well, but they don't work well when we've got secondary infections. And it sounds like if your dog is still having sores, it's time to be going back in. It seems like all I've been harping on during this show is culturing, but it's so important in this day and age with resistant bacteria to make sure that your dog is on the appropriate medication. Often we can manage dogs with superficial skin infections topically. It is a pain in the butt because you're dealing with a large, hairy dog. And when I say, you know, you need to bathe your dog 3 times a week, that might be a little bit of a problem for you, although they tend to be a breed that likes water. So that's one, you know, plus for you. But treating aggressively topically is really important. So usually using a chlorhexidine-based shampoo, using it correctly, leaving it on long enough so that it has some benefit may be helpful. I'm with not actually having your dog and being able to see if there's a yeast infection involved as well. Sometimes we have to have them on antifungal components in the shampoo to be able to keep it under control. So it's often those two go hand in hand. So if your dog isn't getting better with the anti-itch medication, and it's too early to tell with the sublingual drops because you have to wait about a year for that, then I'd be going back in and saying, let's do cytology again, see what organisms we're actually dealing with, maybe get a culture so we can treat appropriately, especially if your veterinarian is thinking about going with an oral antibiotic. I can't tell you how often we're seeing resistant bugs now. It is a daily event in my practice. Yeah.
The shampoo you're talking about, can I buy it over the counter, or do I get it from the vet?
No, it would be a prescription shampoo. The one that we happen to use more often than not at the vet school is one that's called Maliseb, but there are several other brands out there, but they tend to be prescription shampoos.
All right, there we go. Thank you very much for calling. On to Eric in Beloit next. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Speaking of Dachshund Month, I have a Chiweenie.
Okay.
Dachshund Chihuahua, and the issue I wanted to ask about and have you comment on was reverse sneezing. I had never heard of it, completely freaked me out, but apparently it's more common than I thought. Can you maybe tell me a little bit more about it?
Yeah. It is a very common thing. My own dogs do it, and I can see why people get upset, because all of a sudden your dog stops and is making this horrible sound coming out of their back of their nose and throat area. Probably a better name for reverse sneeze, because it isn't a sneeze at all, is a pharyngeal cough. Okay, I know that sounds weird, but normally you cough from your lungs and your airways, but your pharynx, or you know, that part of your where you've gone past the nose, then the next in line is the pharynx, then the larynx, and then, you know, trachea and lungs and so on. That's where this irritation is occurring. So I just had a dog in recently that had, over the weekend, a sudden onset of reverse sneezing. Just crazy, doing it over and over and over. And when they brought him in, I ended up finding that the dog had a loose upper canine tooth that had actually abscessed and broken through into the nasal passage. And so the dog had an infection in the nose that was draining back, irritating the pharynx, and causing the dog to reverse sneeze. We ended up sending the dog to dentistry, had the tooth removed, the oral nasal fistula surgically corrected, and the dog is back to normal again. So sometimes we'll see things like that anatomically or medically be a cause. We can also see dogs reverse sneeze with, there's a nasal mite that dogs can get that it can cause it, and that sometimes we'll just go ahead and say, let's just try treating for that and see if the dog gets better. Sometimes we have dogs that have allergies and a little post-nasal drip that can trigger it. And sometimes it's anatomical. These dogs that have the elongated soft palate, that can be one of the triggers as well. And so I'd be, you know, talking to your veterinarian about doing a good oral exam, having those teeth looked at, making sure there isn't any nasal disease going on. And if it's not interfering with your dog's life, it's just a once in a while thing, then I wouldn't get too concerned about it at all.
There we go. Well, we have a video up on our Facebook page of, see if we can get it up here, of a bird and a cat.
Yeah, it's a cockatoo, and it's grooming the cat. And like, just the cat's just sitting there, he's just very gently preening the cat's head. Oh, my goodness. So doing normal bird behavior, preening, but on a different species, and the cat is tolerating. Probably feels pretty good.
Cat looks pretty content.
It does. It does. I wouldn't want to be bit by that bird. It could probably take that cat's ear off, but it looks like the two are good buddies. So that's great.
Yeah. Go to our Facebook page at the Larry Mealer Show and take a look. I'm telling you, it's worth a look. Oh, man. And you don't have to be a member of Facebook to view that. So on to Ann in Lanesboro. Hi.
Hi. Thank you. Okay, I got a 12-year-old wonderful beagle female named Cricket. She's had a history of seizures, and she's been on Fema-Barbital for probably 5 or 6 years. We recently found out she has congestive heart failure. She was put on 2 more meds, Lasix and Enapril.
Enalapril?
Correct.
Okay.
And she, my question is, she is, she's been incontinent in the house almost every day, like the last week or so, and almost every night.
And that's that Lasix, because what Lasix is a diuretic, and it's making her make more urine. You may want to go back and talk to your veterinarian about some other drugs. I'm not sure how bad your dog's heart failure was, but there's another drug that we use often that will help with the heart pumping effectively, so that we can maybe get your dog on a lower dose of Lasix or even off of the Lasix. And the drug is called Pimobendan. And it's specifically used for dogs in heart failure, and has been found to be very, very helpful. Yeah, this can be, that's one of the big problems is, you know, getting that extra fluid out of their body, and it may hopefully just be a temporary thing. And then if they recheck the dog's chest x-rays and they look like the lungs are clear and the dog's doing better, they can lower that dose of Lasix and maybe just keep things under control by making it easier for the heart to pump, by having them on some enalapril, and then also making the heart muscle a little stronger by using the Pimobendan.
Okay. She's also been real lethargic more than usual.
Yeah, and I mean, a heart failure itself, they can be so tired with that. And it may be that she isn't under control. And so if she's that lethargic, you also want to make sure that when they're on high doses of Lasix, that you're really monitoring their electrolytes. They tend to urinate out a lot of potassium. And potassium is one of those electrolytes that controls muscles, and it can make them be very weak and lethargic as well. And so when we have dogs that are being managed with heart failure, periodically check those electrolytes to make sure that we're not causing them any problems. So that would be something to go back in and ask your veterinarian to get some blood work done if they haven't done that already.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling. On to Camille in New Berlin. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My grand dog has been diagnosed with advanced kidney failure. She's a 10-year-old yellow lab on the small size, about 55 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter took her in she has this large tumor about the size of a hardball, and then to have her teeth cleaned. They did a routine blood test before surgery and discovered that she did not survive surgery because her kidney levels are not functioning.
Oh, my goodness.
They've put her on a strict diet. Her breast smells like fish now, and told her that she can't have any other treats or anything. But she's been kind of aggressive with other dogs, and we've rewarded her every time she was good with treats. And now she's like, how come I don't get my treats, you know?
Yeah.
She doesn't get it.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, A, is there anything that we can do? That I know it's irreversible, but is there anything that we can give her for treats that doesn't compromise her kidney functions?
Yeah, I mean, hopefully that besides being diagnosed with kidney disease, the veterinarian's also doing things like managing the dog's blood pressure, that they've checked the dog over for, since it seems to have come on very quickly as a kind of incidental finding. And good for you for springing for that blood work prior to anesthesia. Really important, especially in senior citizens. But there's a disease that we have in the state here that's called leptospirosis that is treatable. And I don't know whether they've evaluated her for that, because that would be something that can be managed, and sometimes we can get kidney function returning a little bit better. So, putting that out there, and I'm not answering your question regarding what to use for treats. Yeah. But the thing that when we have dogs that are in advanced kidney disease, is you really have to be careful of the protein that's in the food. And so we using things that are a low protein alternative. So things like rice cakes, baby carrots, that type of thing would be just perfect. I think that if it doesn't upset the dog's stomach, those would be fine to be able to use things like that if the dog likes them. But just avoid some of the real meaty, high-protein treats, because that can really throw off that diet.
Okay, and is there any possibility that there was any false readings on the blood test?
Well, we always want to monitor these dogs. And so if I did some blood work and saw that to be the case, I would definitely want to make sure that I'm monitoring these dogs on a regular basis. And so if, you know, typically dogs that have kidney disease are going to be drinking more and urinating more, maybe feeling like nauseated if their kidney values are really high. So it's unlikely that it's a misdiagnosis, but we always want to pair that blood work with a urine sample, because there can be sometimes when dogs have that are dehydrated, you may see one of those kidney values go up. So pairing blood work and a urine sample, getting a lepto test done, I think those, and getting blood pressure checked would all be things that would be indicated.
Oh, good luck. Thank you so much. Jill in Cedarburg, it's your turn. Hi, Jill.
Hi. We have a 14-year-old pit bull female who over the past year has had more incontinence issues. And we're getting to the point where, I mean, she won't even tell us she has to go out. Essentially, she just goes. And she has diapers, and she wears them exclusively all the time. She is on, I think it's Pronin.
Proin, yeah.
And she's on that. She has one tablet with every meal. She eats every 12 hours, 5 a.m., 5 p.m. is there anything else we can do, or is this just kind of our life until she passes on?
Yeah, it really depends on what's causing her to be incontinent. And we do see as dogs get older, sometimes that bladder sphincter becomes weaker. And that's what Proin does, is it helps tighten up that bladder sphincter. And it may be that she's just not on an appropriate dose. The dose is all over the place. We start usually most dogs on 25 milligrams. I have some that need to be up to 50. Some dogs can get by on it twice a day. Some need it three times a day. I've had some dogs that actually need to be on another medication on top of that one, and that would be, usually one of the estrogen-type drugs that are out there. There's some that can be formulated through formulating pharmacies, and then there's one that's called Incurin that is labeled for dog use that you use on a daily basis as well, and that the extra estrogen helps tighten up that bladder sphincter too. Always make sure that there isn't something else going on, that your dog doesn't have a reason for making more urine. So checking blood work to make sure that your dog isn't a diabetic or doesn't have Cushing's disease or kidney disease like the last caller's dog did. Those would be things that we'd want to be monitoring. And the fact that she's 14 and on Proin is one of those drugs that one of the nasty side effects can be it can increase blood pressure. And so we always want to be in those senior dogs monitoring that blood pressure really carefully while they're on that particular medication. So I think there's a lot of things that can be done, but it's a matter of going back to the veterinarian and saying, hey, she's still leaking. What can we do to tweak her medication? And hopefully they have been doing some things like culturing the urine and have done a full physical and ruled out neurological problems that maybe can be addressed differently than a primary bladder sphincter problem.
Right. Yes, that's all been done. Can I ask one quick question? Same dog?
Mm-hmm.
She previously, about 3 years ago, had a blood vessel in her ear kind of get larger and larger, and we were able to combat it with some heat and compress. Same thing is happening on the other ear. Is this just kind of, it happens to an ear and then it never will happen again? Or
so is this, she's developing a hematoma, like a blood pocket? Yeah. Usually we'll see these happen sometimes traumatically. Sometimes if the dog has underlying ear problems, allergy problems, and they're shaking their head a lot, you can get these blood vessels rupturing in the ears too. And it just because it happens once doesn't mean it can't happen again. Often we're looking at draining it, sometimes doing some surgery to get everything, attached back down again, depending on the size of it. And at this point in her life, being a 14-year-old dog, you may want to just handle this conservatively if it's small and not bothering her and just letting kind of Mother Nature take care of it. It's mm-hmm. going to change the way the cartilage looks in the ear, though, and it may become a little more crinkled just because as that blood starts to clot and we do see some cartilage damage occurring.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're
really
welcome.
Appreciate this service. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Rachel on Facebook has, a dog with rough pads. Could that be due to allergies either in his food or outside?
Most of the time when we have dogs with just pads that are kind of coarse and rough, it has nothing to do with allergies. Typically, dogs that have allergies, it's going to be between the toes and the pads, either on the top of the feet, bottom of the feet. But those rough pads, it could just be part of the dog. I mean, I have feet that aren't in the best shape either, a little on the rough side. And so it's kind of just a normal dog thing. If they're bothering the dog, cracking, splitting, you may want to do some further investigating. The problem is like biopsying pads and things can be really difficult. They just don't heal well. Using some of the like things like Musher's Secret, which is a very soothing ointment that is used for working dogs, may be helpful to help keep the feet soft. And it's safe that if the dog were to lick their feet, they're not going to be ingesting anything that would be problematic for them.
Well, here we are, out of time. I hope people have a chance to go to our Facebook page to look at the photos. Jennifer sent a great one of her two little dogs in the cat carrying, or the dog...
Carrier. It looks like you're on a bicycle or something.
Yeah, it's a bicycle carrier for dogs.
Very
cool. Wonderful. Sandy, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're back July 25th.
I am.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, will be back on July 25th. We'll do it all over again. Tomorrow, we'll take a look at invasive plants with our guests, so I hope you'll be with us for that. Stick around, lots in store.